Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Kathy Kelly. It's great to have Kathy back. Kathy is really an extraordinary woman, and that is putting it mildly. In 1996, she helped establish Voices in the Wilderness. The issue was to end repressive UN sanctions against Iraq, lawless sanctions, responsible in the estimation of people who are in the position to know, as many as 1.5 million Iraqi deaths. A story that never gets told. It certainly doesn't get told accurately. We've discussed it a little bit on this program before. Kathy was in Afghanistan. She just came back a week or two ago. We want to talk about what she saw in person, face-to-face, seeing the actuality of what America's legacy in Afghanistan is, what I call a criminal legacy. I have a new article I put out about it this morning. The statistics that I talk about are absolutely horrific. I mean, Kathy sees this firsthand. She's seen it. She's been there before. She spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. But imagine just a few things. Imagine an estimated 55% of Afghan children severely malnourished. It affects them for the rest of their lives, their bodies, their spirit, their souls. Imagine, my goodness, 6% of Afghans have reliable electricity sources. 30% have semi-safe drinking water. 80% of Afghan children lack access to safe drinking water. 6% of them are registered at birth. It means they're non-persons. They have no legal identity. They're vulnerable. They're unprotected. Life expectancy. It's one of the lowest in the world. Pretty close to rock bottom. 44.5 years for men, 44 years for women. After Sierra Leone, Afghanistan has the world's highest maternal mortality rate. 24,000 women die annually giving birth. They have no access to proper any obstetrical or other health services care. Infant mortality is high. 165 deaths per thousand, 165 per thousand before the age of one. I could go on and on and on. Kathy, welcome to the program. You've seen this horror. So Afghanistan really has gone through horrors for many years before America ever showed up. But it's gotten so much worse since America declared imperial war in October 2001 against the country, against the people who rule the country, who had nothing to do with 9/11, and claiming otherwise was a big lie. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for introducing your show by telling what are such grim but important facts to absorb.
It's a horror story. I don't know how else to describe it, Kathy. It really is horrible. And again, you've seen it. You just came back. Talk about the people that you spend time with and who you saw and the impressions that you have, including from your previous trips.
Well, you know, the worst of the winter may have passed now. I notice that temperatures are rising, but it's really very, very cold in Afghanistan. And in Kabul, where we stayed, we had electricity every other day, but that's a luxury compared to most of the country. The big cities are more of a bubble, really, and there's no electricity whatsoever outside of the major cities in the remote rural areas. But it's also a luxury to be indoors with a roof over your head. You know, the refugee displacement within Afghanistan has stayed steady, and it's directly related to violence. People fear that there might be another attack if they're attacked once, or they fear that if one side in a dispute has attacked them, the other side might come and attack the next day. And so people pick up and go and run. And Amnesty International actually reported in 2012 that the war displaces 400 people every single day who flee into already overcrowded cities. So when you're in Kabul, almost in any direction you'd go, you're likely to drive or walk past a refugee camp, and some of these are just huge and sprawling. There's one called Shamane Babrak, and that is, I think, probably the second largest camp. It's been in existence now for at least 7 years. And in that camp, there was just a terrible disaster on top of what was already a calamity for people who were living in very makeshift primitive homes. One woman's cylinder gas heater exploded. She'd had another kerosene lamp nearby, and the two substances combined, and it started a fire, and the fire just raced right through the area of the camp. Fortunately, it was in the middle of the day, so there weren't very many people inside, and three little girls who were caught in the flames were rescued by a very brave uncle. But 70 homes were completely destroyed, and so people who were living rough already were then left with nothing. And to their credit, the neighbors were the ones who came to the fore. There was nothing forthcoming in terms of aid from the government, except that after the fire had already raced through these various mud huts, the fire trucks were finally able to get there and put out the fire. But the neighbors, who were from different tribes, different ethnic groups, I asked the women, you know, were these all members of your family network who took you in and let you sleep with your children in their homes and gave you food? This was just 2 days after the fire. And they said, no, they were our neighbors. And I said, well, you mean different tribes? And they started to call out, yes, Uzbeks and Pashto and Tajiks and from the Hekmatyar clan. And they themselves said, we become like brothers and sisters under these very, very difficult circumstances. So I need to remember that, because when I think about the corruption, the cruelty that's been inflicted on people in Afghanistan, when I think about the horrendous statistics regarding malnourishment and how many children, if they do survive severe acute malnourishment, will grow up stunted and with mental retardation and with the kinds of chronic problems that will persist all throughout their lives. And when I think about the women, one out of every 11 dies in childbirth, and the very, very harsh realities, and at the same time, the amount of money that's being devoted to rifles and bullets and tanks and helicopters and missiles and drone surveillance and weaponized drones and moving military convoys all around the country and moving supplies out now in this largest retrograde mission in military history. And we're talking about a minimum $70 billion for the withdrawal of United States troops to be accomplished and their equipment. And meanwhile, there's not enough resource and ingenuity and funding to adequately allow for salt, iodized salt, to be distributed effectively into the homes of people whose children are suffering malnourishment. And I'm the first one at a dinner table to say, oh, pass the salt, please. Hmm. Imagine they can't get salt. And there are little children who are too weak to cry. They're in these clinics, and they're too weak and tired from this affliction to even cry. And you're right, this comes on the heels of the history of the United States in Iraq. And there were members of Voices in the Wilderness who, along with me, sat at the bedsides of mothers and children. None of those children would go home. They were wasting away. Their mothers would look at us with just mournful numbness. And one friend of mine, a young nurse from Britain, said to me, his name was Martin Thomas, he said, I think I understand. It's a death row for infants, isn't it? A death row for infants. And none of those children committed any crime. So when we talk about criminal governments, and there's plenty of United States acrimony being heaped on the corrupt governance of Afghanistan, and I'm sure that there are plenty of things that have been done that were wrongful and callous, but we ought to look in the mirror, because we're the country that insisted on economic sanctions that directly contributed to the deaths of over 500,000 children in Iraq.
Oh, indeed. So I remember quoting Dennis Halliday several times, who was one of the UN humanitarian coordinators in the Oil for Food program, and he resigned, saying he didn't want anything to do with genocide, and he defined genocide as killing, I forget if it was a week or a month, but he defined it as killing 5,000 Iraqi children every week or every month, a horrific number, and he called that genocide, and he wanted nothing to do with it. He stepped away from it. He wanted to help the Iraqi people and Iraqi children, and he wasn't able to do it because of U.S. policy. And the same thing in Afghanistan, Kathy. It really is a legacy of the worst kinds of crimes. You can only call it genocide or call it slow-motion genocide. And this is what happens in all U.S. wars. None of them are legitimate. They're all illegal. They're not for the purposes intended. In my article that I put out this morning, I quoted George Bush days after America attacked Afghanistan in 2001. I don't have the quote in front of me, but he said something to the effect that America wanted to liberate the Afghan people, improve their lives, and America is a friend for Muslims worldwide, some friend, murdering millions of them. The combination of violence, disease, deprivation, exposure to the elements, all kinds of things have taken the lives, starvation, have taken the lives of millions of people. I think millions in Afghanistan alone, Kathy, and in Iraq. And this is the true legacy of America. You can only call it genocide. I don't know of any other word that best explains it.
Well, you know, the polls, I guess a Pew Research poll was just released, show that the United States disapproval of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is quite high. And that in spite of the fact that people have, I think, been undereducated about realities faced by people in these war zones by the U.S. media. The U.S. media has been, I think, very easy on U.S. policymakers and the U.S. military, often giving them the benefit of the doubt or not following up on stories that should be investigated, or sometimes maligning the people who are trying to investigate atrocities that have been committed. So in spite of the fact that almost no politicians, no elected officials have paid attention to Afghanistan in their campaigning or in the kind of legislation that they would introduce, there still has been an abiding sense that people recognize the cost of the war in Afghanistan is something that they don't want to ever pay again. Now, I think we're a long way from recognizing what the cost of the war has been to people living in Afghanistan. But whether you're a soldier returning to the United States or somebody who was affected by the war in Afghanistan, which I think is just about the entire population, really, it would be true to say the war isn't over when it's over. The cost of the war goes on and on and on, and the effects that it has, and especially when you start to calculate what the effects of displacement and the misspending of resources, the misallocation of resources, has been for people living in Afghanistan.
Indeed so, Kathy. I used a John Pilger quote in my article. I've used it before. It comes from his book, Freedom Next Time, Resisting the Empire, and it really sums up the condition in Afghanistan. And his quote said, throughout all the humanitarian crises in living memory, no country has been abused and suffered more, and none helped less than Afghanistan. So true, Kathy, and it goes back long before America ever arrived. You could go back to the 19th century. It's really been a long-term horror story for the people of Afghanistan, one generation after another. I can't imagine any more gruesome, more ruthless than America, because the weapons today are so vastly more destructive than anything that existed many years ago. So whether it's drone warfare or the kind of weapons used on the ground, I've written a number of times about Afghanistan just in the last couple of years. I've written about how U.S. ground forces make night raids and murder people in cold blood, sometimes raping women and then murdering them to cover up their crimes. I mean, gruesome stories. You just can't believe this stuff unless you really get accurate information. Do the people I call media scoundrels report any of this, Kathy? Not a word. It goes right under their radar. Nothing ever is said. If there's ever a story about Afghanistan, it's turning truth on its head, claiming how America made life so much better for the people of Afghanistan, improved their lives, brought them the kind of things they didn't have before. It's astonishing that this kind of stuff gets reported. Completely false.
A report that had appeared in the Rolling Stone magazine by Matthew Akins one which had some attentive coverage, but then it was very fleeting, really. But it was pretty damning evidence that the reporter had acquired by staying with the story. He had, in the springtime, become aware that Joint Special Operations forces in a place called the Nurkh Valley. It's just, I think, a 25 to 30 minute car ride beyond Kabul, had been certainly present, if not collaborating, with the perpetrator of a crime. An Afghan interpreter had apparently been responsible for torturing and killing 10 people, and their family members said after they were rounded up in a U.S. night raid and apparently had been interrogated, they were never seen again. And there was denial at first. The United States said they had no record of crimes being committed. But this reporter really stayed with the story, and it turned out that a shepherd and his dog were outside the base where this purportedly had happened. And the dog began to dig and uncovered one body, and the neighbors flocked and they uncovered all 10 bodies, and the bodies showed signs of torture. And so there were some eyewitnesses who said that they had seen the U.S. Special Forces people who were present when the interpreter was committing crimes. And so what the reporter did was go on Facebook, and he found the Facebook photos of these Joint Special Operations Forces people who had not only put their photos up, but kind of high fives and all kinds of congratulatory remarks, and kept up their Facebook correspondence with the interpreter who had committed the crimes. And so the reporter took those faces of the ones that the eyewitnesses had said they could identify and put those in with maybe 7 other random faces of military people. And for each of the eyewitnesses, they were able to pick out correctly the faces of the people they said they could identify. So it was a bit like a piece of detective work. But that's the kind of thing that you don't find very many mainstream reporters engaging in Afghanistan, and that's always been needed. It's always been crucial. The New York Times did do a story, and The Guardian followed up later, on malnourishment amongst children in Afghanistan, and I think that's important. But then we have to keep on asking more and more questions. You know, if programs that might cost, say, in the vicinity, I saw one statistic of $6.4 million for bringing fortified foods to possibly as many as 15 million children. Now, I know there are many other problems. It isn't just the money. You have to be able to work out how to get the millers to put the fortified products into the creation of bread, and you have to make sure that the families understand and are educated about why these are important and valuable, and the same for the iodized salt, to make sure that it actually does get sold and or given away for free if that's been part of the rule. But, you know, if we can manage to have $70 billion spent on moving United States military equipment around Afghanistan and getting the troops back to the United States. Surely there could be more resource and ingenuity directed toward trying to help assure that no more children will suffer the agonizing death of dying from starvation in Afghanistan.
So true, Kathy, and at the same time, America literally does not care about the people in the countries that it attacks and invades and occupies. And these wars, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Libya, whether it's Syria, they're all about control. They're about imperial dominance. In the case of Afghanistan, a very strategically located country, Iraq is obvious, so much oil there. Syria, an important regional country. Libya, also an oil story, among other issues. Afghanistan has a lot more resources than most people realize, an enormous amount of wealth that has yet to be developed, so that's an issue. But Afghanistan is also a sort of land-based aircraft carrier. It's another piece in America's plan to encroach on the borders of Russia and China, to encircle them with U.S. military bases, to really weaken them politically, militarily, economically, and this dirty game goes on all the time. So Afghanistan, a very important country. What's going on in Ukraine right now, which is a lot of stuff going on the streets, but you don't have people shooting at each other and mass killing. There's an awful lot of violence, and the story is being completely misreported in the mainstream. I've written a number of articles on Ukraine, but it's the same kind of situation where America wants control of a country. It wants to take it out of the Russian orbit. It wants to get closer to Russia's borders. Russia and China are America's two main rivals. America wants all independent countries' governments removed and replaced by pro-Western stooge governments. That's the dirty game. If you can do it by coups, if you can do it by political one thing or another, if it takes a war, this is what America does. And literally, wars go on all the time, nonstop, every year during Obama's administration, every year during the Bush administration, every year during the Clinton administration. Dare I go on? You could go back. Bush Sr., Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, Harry Truman. It never ends, Kathy.
And, of course, the companies that make huge profits from being the weapon makers and the suppliers for warfare don't want it to end. And I think that's where so much of our task in terms of education lies here in this country, to convince the average, ordinary U.S. people that they're not benefiting from war after war after war. And it's a hard task because people are afraid. They're afraid they'll lose their jobs if defense contractors move out of town. They're afraid that if a base closes down, maybe it will affect them. And so it becomes easy for the war makers to frighten U.S. people or to somehow at least obtain indifference on the part of the U.S. public by trying to persuade people that actually these wars have a humanitarian cast and we have to be in Afghanistan to protect people from the Taliban. Whereas I believe you're right, that was not the goal for the United States to go into Afghanistan, nor was the goal to pursue al-Qaeda or remnants of al-Qaeda. I think that the goal has had everything to do with being able to have geopolitical control.
Indeed,
and control of the pricing and flow of resources.
Kathy, the Taliban today, America's enemies, were the 1980s Mujahideen, the ones that America enlisted to fight against Soviet Russia. And there's a famous photo of Ronald Reagan in the Oval Office with Mujahideen representatives. I've got it in my mind's eye. In my mind's eye, I'm looking at it. Sitting in the Oval Office, he called them the moral equivalent of America's founding fathers. That's almost a direct quote. It may be a direct quote, pretty close to it. So that moral equivalent is now America's enemies, and you could call them al-Qaeda, you can call them anything you want. I mean, America enlists them. Al-Qaeda fighters are supported by America in Syria. The so-called weapons are going directly to them, and the most extremist killers, these are American proxies fighting against the legitimate Syrian government that only the Syrians have a right to decide if they want it or they don't want it. Same thing in Afghanistan. The Karzai government, Kathy, Karzai was a former Union Oil guy in America, a former CIA asset. He's, he's, He's at most the mayor of Kabul. He's no president. If he went out of his compound heavily defended, I think he wouldn't last 5 minutes on the street. So I don't know what he'll do after Americans leave. I don't know whether the Afghan forces want to take care of him or just get rid of him. We'll wait and see, Kathy.
Well, you know, in the New York Review of Books, Anatole Levin wrote about the fact that monies that have gone to the people that are controlling the roadways and kind of demand a tax or a toll paid on every vehicle that goes along the roads that they control are extracting those taxes and tolls from the U.S. military, and that that money is often going into the pockets of the Taliban fighters today or the drug lords today. And when you look at Karzai's cabinet, with the exception of the Minister of Agriculture, it seems to be common knowledge that every cabinet-level minister is somebody who's had war crimes in their past and is engaged as a drug lord or a warlord today. And then when you look at who's running for president and vice president to succeed Karzai, the people that the United States seems to be promoting are the former head of the World Bank, Ashraf Ghani, and General Dostum, who is being investigated for war crimes. And so that's not very reassuring either, given the track record of people involved in high finances in Afghanistan.
Not at all, Kathy. We're getting near the end of the program. I wanted to ask you, you really are a world traveler, and you go into some of the world's real hotspots. Are you planning to go back to Afghanistan soon or another place that that ordinary people would not want to get anywhere near because they're certainly not safe places to be in?
Well, you know, my friends that are in Afghanistan right now who are part of Voices for Creative Nonviolence from the United Kingdom have a really interesting article. They talk about how many dystopian aspects there are to life in Afghanistan today and how hard it is for young people to face that. And so in a sense, maintaining utopian ideals is revolutionary. And so this is going to sound perhaps as though it's outlandish, but we want, in the most conservative Muslim country in the world, amongst people who have literally no income or resources to spare, we want to start a live-in community for young women. So I'm going to go back there February 12th and hope to start initiating that process. We've been fortunate to learn so much from being part of a live-in community for young men, the Afghan Peace Volunteers who have formed an inter-ethnic community and sponsored the Duvet Project, which has delivered this year, it will deliver 3,000 heavy blankets to people who had no protection from winter weather. They've been on a kind of micro scale becoming like brothers and sisters to street children and helping them get enrolled in school and get away from becoming street vendors and get them warm clothing and teach them habits that might be much better for their future. These kinds of programs are very good and edifying, and we want the young women to be able to form a community and support one another, and it's very exciting as a prospect, so I'm going to head back to Afghanistan on February 12th.
Kathy, that's a wonderful initiative, and I mentioned that you coordinated Voices in the Wilderness, which is now called Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, you really are extraordinary, and I would use the term in a way I would use it for very, very few people I either would know or would know of, but you literally put yourself in harm's way, wanting to do what you can to help people who need the most help and get it so seldom from so few people, and you've devoted your life to it. I can't imagine a greater calling than that, Kathy. I look forward to getting you back for more.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation to be with you on the show.
Thanks, Kathy. We'll talk again soon. Join us again over the weekend, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.